Welcome to the What Are Poems podcast, the only poetry podcast not steeped in pretension. I'm live from my living room in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, two blocks away from the bustling fine arts fiesta that I planned on visiting today, but I can't because it's 90 degrees and some men just aren't built for the heat. I discussed this before. I'm a winter boy. I like my sweaters. I like warm drinks. I don't like to be engaged in this battle for my soul when the weatherman says it's going to feel like 100. I like when they say it's going to feel like 102. Really? What the hell's the difference? John Hickey, local Wilkes-Barre weatherman from Vermont, loves the ski slopes, the Boston Red Sox. What is it in this country that we know so much about our meteorologist? Because I think these men are men of science now. We don't have classic weathermen like we used to. We used to have this guy here in Wilkes-Barre named Vince Sweeney, and he had a theme song when I was a child. It went, Vince said it would be like this. Vince said it would be like this. So, like, then there would be people, like, dancing. The sun would be shining. Vince Sweeney would be shaking hands. He was, like, the mascot for the news. He was a man with a beard, and his name was Vince Sweeney, and he had a theme song. Vince said it would be like this. Vince said it would be like this. Yeah. Vince Sweeney. Kind of like the Bozo the Clown for the millennials. The millennials who picked up that WBRE were in that market of the television world. What's your local weatherman like? Do you have a kooky one? I remember when I lived in Philly, there was Glenn Hurricane Schwartz, and I thought that was hilarious. He went by Glenn Hurricane Schwartz. You know? Our weathermen they're the closest thing we have to celebrities that we could touch. I was talking about the Chippendales Rescue Rangers movie last week. I did watch it. I tuned in. I loved it. 5 stars. I dipped my toes in that magical water that is nostalgia. Nostalgia. It's good. There's some jokes. It's like a Roger Rabbit type of thing. Monterey Jack, the comical Australian mouths, is addicted to cheese. So that's that. Nothing else much happened. This week was a rapid fire week. I was just living, you know what I mean? I was waking up, going to sleep. I called off of work on Monday, which I never do. Said, can't come in, not feeling well, under the weather. And then the guy was like, use a sick day then. And I worked in restaurants my whole life, and in a restaurant, there isn't, like, sick days. You literally have to go into the restaurant, beg and plead, and then they're like, well, you could take the day off, but you have to find another human being to cover your position. Which I never lived in a world, I never did a job where you could just not be there and it was fine. Like, if I used to not go to work, then no one would make the sandwiches. You know? I lived in a sandwich economy. For many years in my life, I lived in the sandwich world. And if you're not there making the sandwich, you better, by golly, get another man to make the sandwich. Who's gonna slice the cheese? Who's gonna slice the cheese if you have a fever? That's the world that we used to live in. I think it's getting better now. I don't know. I haven't worked in a restaurant for a couple, 2-3 years now, as they say in Pittston, Pennsylvania. But back in the day, I was cutting the salami. I was chopping the celery. I was making the pizzas. I was doing everything, sweating, dying. And one day off, you get a day off, and you're sweating, you're dying, and you say, I can't come in today. And they say, who's going to cut the salami then? You better find someone. It was this old lady named Hannah who was a secret racist. She said she loved Hillary Clinton the whole time, but she didn't like minorities. Should I blow her up on the podcast like this? That's the fact of the matter. This woman, something happened with her Social Security, and she was upset about it. And she would slice the salami. And she never took a day off. She couldn't. Her husband sold shoes or something. It's just wild how the world works. Did I tell you it's 90 degrees? I can't go to Fine Arts. I was going to go to Fine Arts with my friend MK. We might still go. I don't know. Maybe I'll give her a call later. There's a Frank Sinatra tribute down there in public square where the homeless people free base crack cocaine from 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. Tuesdays through Thursdays. The mayor will probably be there ordering his food from the vendors under the name Mayor. Let me get a chicken on a stick. What's the name? Mayor. I'm the mayor. I see you. I see how you're acting. Got an exciting What Are Pumps podcast today. The guy's name is John Gillespie McGee Jr. He wrote a poem called High Flight. It's a quick life. It's an interesting life. And the idea that I want to kind of discuss here today is legacy. We all have legacies now, right? Like, we don't want them, we don't need them, but we have them. So you're leaving something behind. We all have an imprint we're leaving behind. We're leaving behind pictures on these visible mediums, on the social media. We're leaving behind pictures. We're leaving behind sentiments. We're leaving behind our thoughts on things. So we're all going to have these little mini legacies when they put this generation in the ground. To rot or not. That's trademark. I use that a lot. Put me in the ground. To rot or not. It's not trademark. What the fuck am I talking about? Who am I? You know? Had a few Miller Lights last night saying the confrontation from Les Mis with my friend Phil and our other buddy said, hey, you know, I do have neighbors. Well, I'm sorry. Chalvon, lest we see each other plain. Monsieur Le Maire, you wear a different chain. Before you say another word, Chauvin, before you chain me up like a slave again, listen to me, there's something I must do. This woman leaves behind a suffering child. There's none me could intercede. In mercy's name, 3 days is all I need. Then I'll return. I pledge my word. We were doing that late. And then we drove my buddy's car home, I remember. He's like, I have two cars. Take one. So we're going. The sun's coming up on another Friday night. Burning the candles at both ends. Two friends gliding down the highway. The sky that's sort of gray-blue. Welcome to the morning, boys. You stayed up too late once again to have reverie and fun with your friends, to have a few drinks, to laugh and reflect on the week. The Friday, the happy hour that turns into the happiest hours that then turns into the... What time is it? What day is it? Is it Saturday? Feels like Monday. I got a haircut. I'll tell you about it maybe later. Okay, when I come back, we'll get into this poet. We're going to do it. It's What Are Poems. You're here with me. We are the people. We are the people with the feet, with the legs and the toes. I'll be back. I got the haircut, like I said before, and you know what the lady said to me? She sees me. I only get a haircut once a year. So I go into this place. It's called Great Clips. I don't have a barber. I can't do it. I can't do the barber thing. It would make me too anxious. People have barbers like people have accountants. Like when my friend Piss used to go to H&R Block, and say the guy was his accountant. It's like, no, it's a guy. It's an accountant that works at H&R Block that gave you his card because he has to at the end. And then you go get his taxes done by him every year. The guy's name was Charlie Brown. I probably mentioned that on the podcast in the past, but it always frustrated me that he'd say he had an accountant. And it frustrates me when people say, well, I have a barber. I know it's a whole thing. I know there's men now with tattoos, sharp knives. They give you a nice cut of the beard. They trim your hair nice. They know where the hairline falls. It's a profession. It's a life. It's hip. It scares the hell out of me. So I just go to Great Clips. It's like the Kmart of haircut salon places. You check in on your phone. They text you. They say, okay, get over. You got 15 minutes. So I went up there to get my hair cut, and I'm sitting there in the chair, and they're looking at me, and they're going, holy fuck, look at this guy. Looks like a goddamn Sasquatch. Freaking Thomas J. Yeti over there. Looking for a haircut. We're just trying to get some rest. And you could see all the different people. There's a couple different haircutist, stylist, human beings with their spray bottles and their scissors doing their thing. And I was like, I wonder which one I'm going to get. And the one guy was very talkative. And I was like, please, for the love of God, it's 90 degrees outside. I basically have a musk ox on my face and my head, and I can't be challenged by this man to be kind and personable as he cuts my hair. But I got a nice lady. I didn't get that guy. I got a nice lady, very quiet, very timid. Didn't like Imagine Dragons. Stated up front, I don't like Imagine Dragons. I said, oh, okay. How do you want your hair done? So, okay. So I tell her whatever the hell. I don't know. I don't even know what a haircut is. Remember when you used to go get a haircut? There'd be People Magazine, Us Magazine. There'd be an attractive lady in her early 20s. And she'd say, what kind of cut you looking for, hon? And you would just like say like, oh, I want Joey Tribbiani's haircut from Friends. Give me the Clooney. Now that's gone. Now they have the little receipt paper. It comes out of the computer, and they're cutting your hair. They're going. But anyway, I sit down. She tells me she doesn't like Imagine Dragons. I'm like, cool. She's like, I bet you like records. I said, yeah, I used to collect records. I said, but, you know, they started to collect dust. And as I got older, it affected my asthma. So I got rid of them all. I gave them to my friends, family. I dispersed them. It was like it was the great record giveaway here one night. So here, take a box of records home. I have 400 records. I don't listen to them anymore. I can't even think about putting on the record player, you know, just keep the record player, the radio thing tuned to NPR. I'll put on light jazz if I ever make a salad in the kitchen. Anyway, that's me now. I have shorter hair if I sound different, if I'm acting different, that's why. People have told that to me in the past. They say, I like long hair, Jake. I don't care for short hair. And the haircut guys, it's sleek. It's accidentally sleek. I didn't know she was going to do it sleek. She did a sleek thing. She did a sleek. She put pomade in it. Could be allergic to pomade. Who the hell knows? Okay, so the guy's name is John Gillespie McGee Jr. He's born on the 9th of June in 1922, and he lives up until the 11th of December in 1941. He's a World War II Anglo-American Royal Canadian Air Force fighter pilot and war poet. The idea that there's warrior poets is always interesting to me. The idea of the guy who's out there? Well, World War II, you're pretty much fighting for the good cause. I mean, we got to stop Hitler, right? And he also has these high ideas, you know? Does war at times bring out the best in men? Yes, but why does it exist? I'm a dove, not a hawk. He wrote the iconic sonnet, High Flight. He was killed in an accidental mid-air collision over England in 1941. John Gillespie McGee was born in Shanghai, China, to an American father and a British mother who worked as missionaries. His father, John McGee Sr., was from a family of some wealth and influence in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. McGee Sr. chose to become an Episcopal priest and was sent as a missionary to China. Shanghai, they say that's like there's so many influences there. You ever see the Sand Pebbles with Steve McQueen? I'm pretty sure that takes place in Shanghai. The Sand Pebbles, Steve McQueen, it's a TCM jam. Also with Richard Attenborough in a supporting role. Kills it. Big mustache. Good one. If you want to watch an old movie, that's a good one to put on. The Sand Pebbles. It's one of those pacifist influenced late 1950s war jams. there you have it. So he sent as a missionary to China. And while he's there, he meets his future wife, Faith Backhouse, who came from Suffolk and was a member of the Church of Missionary Society. What I was going to say about Shanghai is that it has a lot of influences, British, American, Russian influences in Shanghai. So it's like this weird melting pot of things. I've always done. I wanted to go. This lady told me her son was in Shanghai. He was in quarantine. They locked him up in one of those tent things. She goes, my son's in Shanghai. I said, that's awful. And I said, I heard there's a lot of different influences, a lot of good food. All this. She's like, oh, it's amazing. She said, but they got him locked in a warehouse. They're giving him rations. They're going to send him out of the country. COVID. It's still happening. The pandemic's not over. If people think it is, it's not. Just want to let everyone know, especially in those red states. Hey, if you're listening in a red state, there is a pandemic still happening. McGee's parents married in 1921, and their first child, John Jr., was born on the 9th of June in 1922, the eldest of four brothers. That's our boy, Johnny Gillespie, McGee Jr. McGee began his education at the American School in Nanking in 1929. In 1931, he moved with his mother to England and spent the following 4 years at St. Clair, a preparatory school for boys in the county of Kent. From 1935 to 1939, he attended Rugby School, where he developed the ambition to become a poet. And while at this school, he won poetry prizes in 1938. He was impressed by the school's roll of honor listing its pupil who had fallen in the First World War, which included the Edwardian poet Rupert Brooke, whose writing style McGee emulated. Brooke had won the school's poetry prize 34 years prior to McGee. The prize-winning poem by McGee centered upon the burial of Brooks' body at 11 o'clock at night in an olive grove on the Greek island of Circus. Skyros, sorry, like Gyro, Skyros, in April 1915. So now we have dueling men. Both went to this rugby school in England. Both are going to serve in world wars. Both write in a style, a sonnet style. Maybe we'll do Rupert Brooke next week, and we'll see the whole thing. But he has a sonnet to Rupert Brooke that he wrote, and I believe this is the one that he won the prize for. But don't quote me. At times, I can be inaccurate. We laid him in a cool and shadowed grove. One evening in the dreamy scent of time, where leaves were green and whispered high above, a grave as humble as it was sublime. There, dreaming in the fading deeps of light, the hands that thrilled to touch a woman's hair, brown eyes that loved the day and looked on night, a soul that found at last its answered prayer. There, daylight as a dust slips through the trees and drifting gills and drifting gills the fern around his grave, where even now perhaps the evening breeze steals shyly past the tomb of him who gave new sight to blinded eyes, who sometimes wept, a short time dearly loved, and after slept. So that's Gillespie's jam, his jam out to Rupert Brooke, who was his forebearer of the winner of this poetry prize 34 years prior. That's crazy. So, at Rugby, McGee fell in love with Eleanor Lyon, the daughter of P.H.B. Lyon, the headmaster. In later life, an accomplished children's author, she became the inspiration of many of McGee's poems. Though his love was not returned, he remained friends with Eleanor and her family. So, he's got that schoolboy crush. This guy's very relatable. He's haunted by the ghost of the past, and he's fallen in love. He's a teen in love. McGee visited the United States in 1939, staying with his mother and brothers in Martha's Vineyard. He also visited relatives of his father in Pittsburgh, part of a very wealthy extended family, which included the Mellons, as in Carnegie Mellon. One of these relatives was his uncle, Pittsburgh lawyer and congressman James McDevitt McGee, who had served as first lieutenant in the United States Army Air Service during the First World War. During McGee's stay in Pittsburgh, he participated to the full in the social life available to him there, including the Rolling Rock Club. That's Rolling Rock beer. What's it say? 49, 39? What's the number on Rolling Rock? Anyway, it's made in the glass-lined tubes of Latrobe. I'll find out for sure on you there. His expenditures on these activities attracted critical correspondence with his clergyman father, so his dad doesn't like him hanging out at the Rolling Rock Club getting down. What is the Rolling Rock Club? Shall we investigate? What Our Poems Investigates, the Rolling Rock Club. The Rolling Rock Club was a private country club located on 10,000 acres along U.S. Route 30, about 50 miles from Pittsburgh Laughlintown? Laughlintown, Pennsylvania. Rolling Rock Club was originally 12,000 acres of land owned by Judge Thomas Mellon, who left it to his son Richard Beatty Mellon, brother of Andrew Mellon, all the Mellons, the Mellon Bank. It's a golf course. There's hunting stables. It's the Rolling Rock Club. I don't see the connection to the beer. There is no connection to the beer. I'm just talking about the beer. You ever had the beer? It's hoppy. They changed the recipe. Be careful if you're going to try it for the first time. You might get scared. You might say, this is too hoppy. Why'd you recommend a Rolling Rock to me? But it's called Rolling Rock. It's just a great name for a beer. It's green. It gets skunked easy. Am I selling it or not selling it? I'm going to call my friend. He's going to tell us all about his experiences with Rolling Rock at the end of the show. That's going to be the end of the show. I'm going to call my friend. I'm going to say, you just talk about Rolling Rock for a second here. Okay, so because of the outbreak of World War II, McGee was unable to travel to Britain for his final school year at Rugby and instead attended Avon Old Farm School in Avon, Connecticut. The school headmaster, Reverend W. Brooke Stabler, later recalled an incident during the winter of 1939-40 when after a school dance, I love this. This gives you an idea who we're dealing with, who this guy is. I like these little snippets you get of a life of these poets sometimes. Like you see these people who write these beautiful things and put them into the world, and they do have this and have those legacies, but sometimes they do something that's just, it just happens. It's just a life event. And that's also part of it, you know? So here it is. McGee climbs a tall tree after the dance to rescue a cat. Before he had come down out of the tree, there was a circle of admiring girls watching him from the ground. So he just gets out of the dance. He sees the cat tree and he climbs the tree and all the girls are just like, oh. And he writes poetry. This motherfucker. His attitude toward the war gradually evolved from one approaching pacifism to a decision to become a pilot to help protect his friends in Britain. So the call to arms is one afternoon after lying on top of the tower for a couple hours in the sun, McGee turned to his companion and suddenly announced, well, I think I'll join the RAF. There he is, just rescuing cats, hanging on the school roof. He looks at his buddy and he says, well, war's on. My friends from the rugby school, they're in trouble. I guess I'll join the RAF. And just like that, his fate's pretty much sealed and decided. He once stayed with his family in Martha's Vineyard in the summer of 1940, learning to drive and having a very active social life. Mornings on the beach, surrounded by a bevy of girls, dances, beach parties, occasionally a drop too much of alcohol, wild drives around the bay to the Vineyard Haven in Edgartown, and grave discussions with his father on the state of the world, or some phase of Christian living. When his father, would speak to him throughout the night. He asked him once about night turning into day, and John answered, my generation does not expect to live long, and we may want to enjoy ourselves while we may. So he knows it's coming. He knows the war's coming. After discussions with his parents, he joins the Royal Canadian Air Force with the intention of learning to fly and being sent to Britain accordingly. Well, he had been offered a scholarship to Yale University, but did not enroll. McGee joined the RCAF in October of 1940 and received flight training in Ontario at No. 9 Elementary Flying Training School. Shortly after his promotion to the rank of pilot officer, after being awarded his wings, McGee was sent to the United Kingdom, where on arrival he was posted to No. 53 Operating Training. After completing his training with the 53, he starts with a Canadian unit formed at RAF Digby. No. 412 Squadron was part of the Digby Wing, commanded by the legendary Cowboy Blatchford. I don't know him because I don't know a lot about Canadian history, but Cowboy Blatchford is his leader. He does one raid on November 1941. He took part in the sortie to occupied France, escorting bombers, attacking railway road ships at Lille. So he's on the raid. And then on December 11th, 1941, pretty much a month later, in his 10th week of active service, McGee was killed by a flying Spitfire. He had taken off in the late morning with other members of the squadron to practice air flight tactics during the performance of which McGee's aircraft was involved in a mid-collision with a different aircraft, same side. His body was buried in the graveyard of the Holy Cross Church in the village in Lincolnshire. On the gravestone are inscribed the first and last lines of his poem, High Flight. Part of the official letter to his parents read, your son's funeral took place at a cemetery near Digby Aerodrome at 2:30 p.m. on Saturday, December 1941, the service being conducted by Lieutenant S.K. Belton, the Canadian Padre of this station. He was accorded full service honors, the coffin being carried by pilots of his own squadron. So then he writes this, during this time, he writes this poem, High Flight. So, I found kind of like an epic recording of it, so I'm just gonna play that for you, gang, and you're gonna enjoy it. So here's High Flight by John Gillespie McGee. He wrote this during his time in World War II.
High Flight by John Gillespie McGee Jr. Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun's split clouds and done 100 things you have not dreamed of, wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there, I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up the long, delirious, burning blue, I've topped the windswept heights. With easy grace, where never lark or even eagle flew. And while the silent, lifting mind I've trod, the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God.
It's a good story, right? That's what he leaves back. He kind of tells his tale, his story about what it meant for him to fly and be amongst the clouds, and writes this like beautiful poem. So his posthumous fame rests mainly on that sonnet, High Flight, which he began writing on the 18th of August, 1941, just a few months before his death while stationed near London. His father, then curate of St. John's Episcopal Church in Washington, D.C., reprinted it in the church's publication. The poem became widely known through the efforts of the Librarian of Congress, Archibald McLeish, who included in an expedition of poems called Faith and Freedom at the Library of Congress in 1942. The manuscript copy of the poem remains at the Library of Congress. During April 1942, many Hollywood stars, including Laurel and Hardy, Groucho Marx, Cary Grant, Bing Crosby, and Bob Hope, joined the Hollywood Victory Caravan as it toured the United States. Actress Merle Oberon recited High Flight as part of this show. During the performance at the Lowe's Capitol Theater in Washington, D.C., before she recited High Flight, Oberon acknowledged the attendance of McGee's father, John McGee, and brother Christopher McGee. It's a favorite poem amongst aviators and astronauts, and it's the official poem of the Royal Canadian Air Force and Royal Air Force, and has to be recited from memory by fourth-class cadets at the United States Air Force Academy, where it can be seen on display in Cadet Field House. Portions of the poem appear on many headstones in the Arlington National Cemetery, and it is inscribed in full on the back of the Space Shuttle Challenger Memorial. It is displayed on panels at the Canadian War Museum in Ottawa, the National Air Force Museum in Canada, in Trenton, Ontario. It is the subject of a permanent display at the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton, Ohio. So, there you have it, John Gillespie McGee. Cool dude. Solid dude. Reasons that he fights in the war are real reasons. Good reasons. He just seems like he's just floating through life. Seems like he's just the type of guy you'd want to meet, I feel. I like the poem. I just stumbled upon it the other day. I like the poem. And then when I started reading about the dude and the short life and just kind of how his entire life seems to forebode doom. You know, there's that feeling when you read his life that this isn't going to end well. And almost like he knows it's not going to end well. He's on that road to destiny, you know. He's going to write this great poem and he's going to be gone. And it's the thing with war, you know. Who do we lose? Who are the people that are gone in wars, and what would they have done after if they kept existing, if they kept being part of this all? That's some thoughts, right? That's some heavy stuff. We're doing it here on What Are Poems. We're thinking. My girlfriend got a turkey that you like shoot in you put in your yard for archery practice. It's like a turkey statue. And it's just in the house. It just stares at me all the time. And I just go, oh, this fucking turkey. Hey, when I come back, I'm going to text my friend quick. I'm going to find out all about what the Rolling Rock thing says. And I'll give it back to you. Right? Maybe I'll write a poem about it. Who knows? Hey, stay tuned, folks, for the end of the episode, my dear friends.
This is a beer that's everything a fine imported beer ought to be. It's brewed with all natural ingredients, the way fine imported beers are brewed. Bottled in tall green glass, the way fine imported beers are bottled. This is Rolling Rock, Rolling Rock Premium Beer, brewed by by the Latrobe Brewing Company and imported in bottles and cans from Latrobe, PA.
That's a Rolling Rock commercial from 1986. God bless it. My buddy never got back to me. I can't wait all day for this guy to text me back, you know? He always says that everything's suspect. That's his big thing. That's suspect, he'll go. That's suspect. So I'm there tonight. I said, hey, why don't you take this half dollar coin and try to stand it up on the bar? He said, good God, I can't do it. So it's it says the number is 33 is printed predominantly on all bottles of Rolling Rock beer. Many have speculated the significance of the number 33, that the 33 refers to 1933, the founding year of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Rolling Rock, from the glass lines of the tanks of Old Latrobe, we tender this premium beer for your enjoyment as a tribute to your good taste. It comes from the mountain springs to you. The original label said, a little nip from the glass line takes of Old Latrobe. We tender this package as a premium beer for your delight and economical use. It comes from the mountain springs to you. That's Rolling Rock Beer, also not a sponsor, but we got to the bottom of it, didn't we, folks? And we're counting that as a poem. That Rolling Rock that Rolling Rock commercial is my poem this week. Hey, remember you can submit your own poems to the podcast at whatarepoemspodcast@gmail.com. Send them in. And I got a lot of letters, emails. Well, emails, I don't get letters. No one's handwriting me letters. But I got a lot of emails last week when we were talking about being down and out and depressed. And everyone who reached out, stick in there, stay in there. And we'll keep the correspondence up. All right. Till next time, peace and love, Beef Jackie.